Okay, good evening. Thank you for coming. And, special welcome to Rabbi Ari Rakoff from Reach Press. And, thank you for coming. This is a yahrzeit shiur, as you know, for my father, Rabbi David Feldman, Zichrono Livracha. For those of you who are keeping track, you may realize that it's not exactly his yahrzeit now, which actually took place in Kislev, but it was postponed till now because we wanted to wait until this book was released, which is dedicated both in his memory and also in honor of my mother, Rebbetzin Aviva Feldman. However, another consequence of the timing is that my mother is also not here tonight because she's recovering from a scheduled surgery. Thank God she's doing quite well, but she's in Care One, just a few blocks away. As Hashem, she will be well very soon. And so this is dedicated in honor of both of them. And the theme of this book, which is available in the back, is called Letter in Spirit, and subtitled Evasion, Avoidance, and Workarounds in the Halachic System. And the theme is to address various mechanisms in halacha which sometimes look like they are getting around halacha, have the appearance of sometimes called a loophole. It's a word I don't like very much, a word I don't think is necessarily fitting. Maybe a workaround is a better way of putting it. Some famous examples, as we'll discuss, are Mechiras Chametz or Prusbul, devices such as this, which often raise questions about how exactly are they accommodated within halacha? Are they an escape from what we're really asked to do? Are they an evasion of our actual halachic responsibilities? And in the course of exploring these topics, there are various other themes that emerged and that I wanted to focus on tonight specifically as reflective of why I wanted to dedicate this work to my parents. And one of the major themes that I wanted to focus on tonight especially is the theme of rabbinic responsibility, as emphasized in the title for tonight's lecture, something that I thought was quite striking as you notice when you take a look at the literature regarding all of these topics, is just how impressive it is, the theme that emerges of the responsibility that rabbinic leaders have felt throughout the generations for their flock, for their people, and the balance that they brought to the questions of the spiritual needs of the people, the economic needs of the people, the social needs of the people, and some very striking examples that come out from the literature. And what I'd really like to do is just go through some of those examples, and I think they are somewhat awe-inspiring to consider the messages that come out simply from looking at those examples. And another major theme that is very much a part of why I wanted to write this book is the theme of avoiding cynicism. And that is also very much something that was important to my father and to his message. And he wrote an article, it's actually about the mourning practices during Shir HaOmer that was widely circulated. And he emphasized there that a major role of the rabbi is to make sure that people do things for the right reasons and that they not be caught up by cynicism and by doing things for the wrong reasons. And that was also a major goal of this book, to understand that that's so crucial, that we not be distracted by cynicism or be overtaken by those kinds of attitudes. And it happens to be that that's actually timely, that here we are, the week of Parsha Zachar, and the theme of Amalek, believe it or not, is actually associated with cynicism. We have an imagery that Chazal have, that they connect Amalek with the theme of Leitzanus, which is hard to understand. When we picture Amalek, the idea of a clown is not the first image that would come to mind, but Chazal do make that connection to Pasuk in Mishle, Letz Takei Ufesi Arim. You have the word Yarim is actually connected to the word Harama, which is one of the major themes of the book, but the word Letz, Chazal associate with the idea of Amalek. And Rav Huttner, in his first essay in the Pachir Yitzchak on Purim, explains that the connection of Leitzanus to Amalek is not that they are a clown, not that they joke around and that they're funny, but the idea of Leitzanus in rabbinic literature and in biblical literature is a scoffer, is a cynic, somebody who doesn't take anything seriously. And that is so corrosive, that is so destructive. And Amalek, their whole message was that the Jews are not formidable, that they don't have anything important to add to the world, and you don't have to be scared of them. And Chazal have that imagery that the Jews were like a boiling bath that everyone was afraid to jump into. And Amalek said, we can jump in and we can show you that they're not so formidable. And that message of trying to knock down that which looks like it's formidable, that's the effort of the cynic, and part of Zechiras Amalek is to combat cynicism. So this was a major theme, a major goal of writing this book, that we shouldn't approach these methods with a cynical attitude, and we should recognize that there's a system behind them, that there is a mechanism there, that there is a sense of a structure that the rabbinic leadership was bringing to their responsibility towards the people, and that's something you come to appreciate when you work through the literature. So all of this is one of the major goals. So that, together with this theme of rabbinic literature and rabbinic responsibility, is something that I want to emphasize tonight. One of my parents' major mantra in their rabbinate is the idea of meeting people basher husham. It's a pasuk in Parshas Vayera, which, taking a little bit out of context, nonetheless has a special application in terms of how you relate to people and recognize their particular needs, and understand that you have to be able to appreciate what it is that's appropriate for each person in their circumstance, and recognize that that's a part of what rabbinic responsibility is. And that is something, again, that emerges so powerfully from the literature, and that's a little bit of what I want to try to convey as I describe some of the content of the various chapters over the next few minutes. So just to begin with, the first chapter is about the topic of the Heter Iska. The Heter Iska is a mechanism that emerged about 500 years ago to address the prohibition of ribbis. The Torah prohibits taking interest on loans, and that's a very strict and absolute prohibition. One's not allowed to collect any extra money after giving a loan, but there emerged the capital economy, and that posed the problem: how is it possible to provide any capital for investment purposes and to make a profit off of that? So there emerged this technique called the Heter Iska, which restructured such loans as investments and allowed for profit participation, and that required a whole explanation as to how that approach was legitimate. And the Torah Tumimah, for one, explained that this was a reflection of the rabbi's recognizing that there was a major shift in the economy, that before the economy had moved to this capital model. So at that point, there was this major shift. So before that point, when somebody borrowed money, it was because they were in a very dire economic situation, and the person who was lending the money wasn't undertaking any opportunity cost by providing that money. But after there was this economic shift, now it wasn't necessarily the case. Now it could be that someone could come and borrow money, and it wasn't because they were in a desperate situation. It was because they had something to invest. It was because they were pursuing a business opportunity. And the one who was providing the money was now taking on a opportunity cost. So how could we address that shift in the economic reality? And further, the Chelkas Yaakov, or Yaakov Breisch, writing later, who's a great posek from Switzerland, who was very sensitive to all of these issues, so he felt that there was a tremendous crisis that was being addressed, because it was impossible for the Jews to participate in the economy if there wasn't going to be some structure that was going to address this. And he wrote that we see that Chazal were sensitive to the needs of Agunos, which is something we'll discuss in a few moments. And therefore, similar to that, this was something that was relevant to the entire community, to the entire Jewish society, and therefore they had to worry about this as well, because this goes to the economic survival of the entire Jewish population, and therefore they had to find a way to address this, and that's how the Heter Iska emerged. But if that's the case, so then this could only be utilized for the purpose of business loans, for capital investment, and it had to be carefully balanced with the fact that the Torah had the prohibition of ribbis in order to protect the idea of loans that were there for chesed, loans that were there for the needy, for people who were in dire economic straits. And therefore, Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, was very insistent that a heter iska not be used when somebody is borrowing money because they can't pay the bills, when somebody has economic pressures and is borrowing for those purposes. And similarly, the Chafetz Chaim in his Avos Chesed was very emphatic that one had to make sure that even if there was an allowance for a heter iska for business purposes, that that shouldn't interfere with the availability of funds for chesed purposes, and that we had to make sure that one wasn't going to interfere with the other. So there was a constant sense of responsibility on the part of the rabbinate that on the one hand, okay, we have to make sure that the Jews can make a living and that we have to make an allowance for there to be a possibility of collecting what would otherwise be interest so that they could pursue business opportunities. But at the same time, that shouldn't impinge on what the Torah's intentions were, so that there should be the possibility of providing loans and the availability of loans for the needy. At the same time, there were other considerations. So how could you make sure that those who were pursuing business as the rest of society was wouldn't be violating prohibitions of interest? So there was an institution that developed called the Heter Iska Klali, where businesses could set up in advance a system that dictated that everything that they were doing was under the understanding of this profit participation rather than prohibited interest, a Heter Iska Klali, as it was called, that was put up on the walls of these institutions, and it was a general declaration. And while there were some who questioned whether that was effective or not, other rabbinic leaders thought that this was a responsibility of the community to make sure that this was put into place so that the masses wouldn't violate the prohibition of interest. So, for example, Rav Shmuel Engel, the Maharash Engel, was very concerned about this, and he had a very striking comment in his responsa. He said that the rabbis have to make sure that this utilization is put into place, and he wrote that if the rabbis fail to do this, they would be in violation of the Torah prohibition of Lifnei Iver, of being responsible for causing others to sin, because this is a part of their responsibility for their community to make sure that these tools are being utilized in order to reduce the possibility of violating the prohibition of interest. And along these lines, there was a suggestion almost exactly 100 years ago, around 1922, by Israel Eger, who was a great-great-grandson of Rabbi Akiva Eger, thought that we should put into effect a policy across the board that everyone should have a personal heter iska klali. They should make a declaration that all of their interactions in business will be under this understanding of heter iska, that every loan that they would do would be structured as an investment rather than a loan, so that if they forget to make a individualized heter iska, it wouldn't be perceived as prohibited interest, it would be perceived as an investment instead, and that would save them from the prohibition of interest. And this was very controversial. There were those who thought this would lead to a laxity regarding the prohibition of interest. There were those who thought that this wouldn't suffice in order to address the prohibition of interest and better to make sure that people just dealt with it the proper way instead of having these general catch-all methods. And there was an extensive back and forth in the rabbinical journals as to whether this was adequate or not. But the whole literature is fascinating to read because it displays just how much the rabbis of that time were concerned about finding that exact balance. How do we make sure that the people have what they need in order to make a living? And at the same time, how do we address all the possible pitfalls and make sure that they're not going to stumble over a prohibition because of a lack of awareness, because of economic pressures, because of a lack of education, or because of any other factor? And how do we make sure to address every situation with all of the circumstances accounted for? So all of this is coming off the perspective and the assumption that the prohibition of interest is directed specifically at loans that are there to provide for the needy and not loans that are there for business purposes, and that that was the justification for the heter iska, which seems like a justified premise, but not everyone agreed. So, for example, Rav Asher Weiss thought that the heteriska really is not so justified from that premise, and that really it became a way of lending money with interest that we've come to accept. So if that's the case, so then the question becomes, why have we come to accept it? If it's a violation, essentially, of the Torah's prohibition of lending money with interest, so why should we come to accept it? So it comes to be, then, that that's a different perspective, that we're balancing it against another concern, that the Torah has a mitzvah to lend money in the first place, and we find that the Talmud tells us that we're very concerned, often, shlotino delos bifnei lovin, that we don't want to close the door in front of people who need loans, and anything that may discourage lenders from providing to the needy is something that we're worried about, and sometimes we have to make a trade-off. So even if we're going to compromise in other areas, and even if we're going to tolerate something which may otherwise be stretching the prohibition of collecting interest, but if it means that loans are going to be more available, so sometimes we have to make a trade-off, and sometimes the rabbinic leadership will tilt in that direction. And that seems to be what's going on also when it comes to Prusbul, which is one of the most well-known areas where there's a controversy in terms of understanding it, and that's the topic of a whole other chapter in the book, but that certainly seems to be what's going on there. That's an older institution, and that's a topic of a discussion in the Mishnah and an extensive discussion in the Talmud and Maseches Gittin, that was the decision that Hillel made, that even though the Torah tells us that at the end of the Shemitah year, loans are supposed to be canceled, and nowadays we assume that that's true by function of rabbinic law, because we assume today that Shemitah is not currently in effect by Torah law, but it's in effect by rabbinic law. But as the Mishnah tells us, that Hillel was afraid that if we insisted on that rule, that the loan should be canceled, so simply the case would be that loans would not be available to those who need it. So we have to weigh the various concerns. On the one hand, yes, we want to preserve this idea that the mentality of Shemitah that says that loans should be canceled, so we want to preserve that idea, but at the same time, if that's going to lead to a consequence that people who need loans aren't going to receive them because lenders are going to be afraid to provide them, so that's going to be a unintended consequence that's going to be of greater negative impact. And therefore, the rabbis were concerned about that, and Hillel led the pack and instituted Prusbul in order to make sure that that careful balance was struck. And in doing so, he made sure that the needy would still receive loans. But by creating this institution of Prusbul, he put something else in place that would preserve the mechanism of Shemitah so that the message of Shemitah would still endure and all of its other points would be able to carry through. So here again, you have that careful balance. And then we have perhaps one of the most well-known mechanisms, and one that's coming up in just a few weeks, believe it or not, but Mechiras Chametz. And Mechiras Chametz is a fascinating discussion. And just to zero in on three areas that are particularly interesting, where you find this sense of rabbinic responsibility coming out in ways that I thought were particularly striking and powerful. So one was a discussion by the Maasas ben Yamin in the 1600s. The Maasas ben Yamin wrote that he was terribly troubled and he couldn't sleep at night because of a certain problem that he had, that the halachos of Mechiras Chametz dictate that when you sell the chametz to the non-Jewish purchaser, it has to be an absolute sale and it can't be conditioned on anything. So in order for it to be a genuine sale, you can't make it that the purchaser is obligated to sell it back to the original Jewish seller. It has to be totally unconditional. He can do with it whatever he wants. But in his day, the situation was in the Maasas ben Yamin's community, there were unscrupulous Jews who, right after Pesach, would swoop in and undercut the original Jewish seller, and they would buy the chametz at a lower price. So the original seller was selling his entire business because their whole livelihood was in the whiskey industry or the beer industry, so they had to make a living through that industry, and they sold all of their livelihood to the non-Jew over the course of Pesach, and they were at risk of losing it all because others would swoop in after Pesach and buy it all up. And the Masas Binyamin said he couldn't sleep at night because he had to figure out how could he maintain the integrity of the sale. He couldn't make it conditional to sell it back to the original Jew, but at the same time, how could he protect that original Jew from having somebody else undercut him and buy it before he could get it back after Pesach? And indeed, he came up with an ingenious solution. I won't tell you what it is here. You can buy the book and read it. But he figured out how to solve this problem. He said he couldn't sleep until he figured out how to solve this problem. And it was very striking just reading this literature because he wrote that he had to figure out how to balance these two considerations. How could he maintain the integrity of the sale and also preserve the livelihood of the Jewish people, and that was a part of the responsibility that the rabbinate has felt throughout the generations. And a second example from the Mechiras Chametz literature had to do with a controversy that took place a few hundred years ago in Romania, that it used to be, they had a model that was different from what we did today, that it used to be that the way chametz was sold before Pesach was on an individual level, that every Jew would sell a chametz to his non-Jewish neighbor, and that's how they would do it. Not like we have today, where a rabbi is appointed by the people of his community as an agent to sell the chametz on their behalf. So people would do it on an individual basis, and there's a lot that could go wrong. It's very complicated to sell chametz, so there were a lot of mistakes that were made, and it wasn't such a great system. So eventually it transitioned to the system that we have now, which is much smoother, because presumably the rabbi knows how to make the kinyanim in a much more effective way, and it is somewhat complicated. So what we have now is a much more effective system. But a few hundred years ago, as it was transitioning from what it was to what it is now, there was a system that was very controversial and led to a whole fight in Romania, where this was taking place among other communities, that they had one Jew who was purchasing it from all the other Jews in the community, and that one Jew would then sell it to one non-Jew. So this was very controversial in a certain community in Romania called Yos, or Jassy in English, and the two rabbis who were in the community had a big fight about this. There was a Rabbi Toibish, who's actually an ancestor of our own Rabbi Talbis, and Rabbi Levine, who the two of them had a big fight about this, and one recommended this arrangement, and the other one said, it can't be, that's already too much of a joke. To believe that you're selling your chametz over the course of Pesach, okay, we'll accept that, but to believe that this one Jew is purchasing everybody else's chametz and he's not normally in the business, and all of a sudden, one day a year, he's purchasing everybody else's chametz and then selling it himself when he can't afford to do that, it doesn't make any sense. I don't believe that. That can't be. And they had a big fight about this. So Rav Shlomo Kluger, who was one of the Gedolei Hador at that time, he was brought in to weigh in his opinion, and he wrote a whole long tshuva about it, and he ultimately supported this arrangement. But what's fascinating to read is he gives a whole lecture to the opponent, and he says, the people who oppose this, they don't understand what it's like to be a rabbi in a large community, and you don't understand what can go wrong and how challenging it is to deal with all of the different issues, and you have to realize that you have to be bocher b'miyot tara, you have to choose the lesser of two problems, and you have to realize all of the different complexities. And he said, you're right, it is challenging, and for those who know what they're doing, I would recommend that, yes, you should still do it on the individual basis, because there are complexities here, but for the rabbim, it is necessary to have an institution like this, and that's something that the people in the smaller communities who haven't dealt with the larger challenges of the big city rabbinate, they didn't appreciate, and he gives this whole lecture there in this tshuva, which is all very fascinating to read. And then a third point from Mechiras Chametz, which is also quite fascinating in the literature, is to read that literature from the 20th century regarding supermarkets and the question of supermarkets that continue to be open over the course of Pesach and that are selling chametz to Jews and to non-Jews over the course of Pesach, and whether that can be tolerated and whether you can sell the chametz of those stores and tolerate that situation that they're continuing to do business, which is clearly far from ideal. The idea that we here sell our chametz over the course of Pesach, so we lock it up and we don't have anything to do with it over the course of Pesach. But the idea that somebody who owns a store, who is presumably not observant and is going to then keep selling that chametz to customers over the course of Pesach, that would seem to be a open falsehood, because how could he claim to really be selling it to a non-Jewish purchaser and then continue to do business with it? And there's all kinds of things wrong with that. So could there be any validity to that? Is there anything to be accomplished with that at all? And there were many who were greatly opposed to that. Rav Soloveitchik was greatly opposed to that. Many were firmly against that. But there were those who thought that there's still something to be accomplished, and anywhere that we can save any transgression, we have to do whatever we can. And there were those who found what that could be endorsed about this, including Rav Moshe Feinstein, including the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who had various arguments where he said that if there's anything that we can save in terms of transgressions, so we have to do what we can. And once again, the Chalkis Yaakov from Switzerland had some very fascinating responsa where he went into great detail about all of the different reasons where if there's any area in which we can minimize the transgressions of the public, so we have to do what we can. And they articulated all kinds of arguments as to why there was something that can be accomplished, even though it's clearly far from ideal, but this is something that we still have to advocate. And then shifting to one of the great controversies of the 20th and 21st centuries, the Heter Mechira in Israel, selling the land in Israel before the Shemitah year in order to deal with the challenges of Shemitah, which is actually far more controversial than the sale of Chametz before Pesach. The Heter Mechira is kind of a perpetual motion machine for machlokas, because every 7 years it becomes an even more intense machlokas. Somehow it was intensely controversial in the late 1800s when it was first utilized. In every Shemitah cycle, it becomes a whole new machlokas, and it gets totally reinvigorated as a whole new fight, and both sides say, okay, if you didn't agree with me last time, now you for sure agree with me, because now the circumstances have totally changed in my favor to my side, so it becomes a whole new fight every 7 years. And it's fascinating here to see as well how both sides are animated by the same concerns of trying to preserve the sanctity of Shemitah and the intent of the Torah, but also recognizing the needs of the people and the efforts of the communities to survive. And on the one hand, in the era before the state and the early settlements in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, when the economic challenges were tremendous and the arguments that were made at that time, and in particular, Rav Kook and his father-in-law, the Adaret, who at first opposed the Heter when they were living in Europe, and then when they came to Israel and they saw just how serious the economic circumstances were, so then they made arguments to recommend it because of that recognition. And then much more recently, the writings of the chief rabbis who evaluated each time and made the decision that they're going to continue recommending it, even though now we have the state and we have a startup nation and we have a big thriving economic system, but maybe that's a reason all the more so than to say, okay, that becomes a greater dependency on all of the factors that go into it and all of the considerations that go back and forth and the various levels of observance that are tied in to the different people who are dependent on this. So reading the literature here and seeing once again the sense of responsibility that is reflected by Rav Bakshi Daron and Rav Mordechai Eliyahu and Rav Adji Yosef and all of those who wrote in recent years about the Heter Mechira is once again very striking, just to see what is emerging. And here, as I'm talking about my father's yahrzeit, so on this topic specifically, his great-grandfather, who was a Rav by the name of Zvulun Leib Barit, who wrote letters to Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, and he wrote about the Heter Mechira, and he noted there that he thought that it was something worth commenting upon, that there were those who wrote very negatively about the Yishuvim in this pre-state era and their reliance on leniencies regarding Shemitah. And he said, but it's a little bit ironic, you have to give them credit, because yes, you're going to say that the Talmud says that the Jews were thrown out of the land of Israel because they were lax when it comes to Shemitah, but if you're going to criticize them for that, then you have to also acknowledge that what they're doing is important, that they're settling the land, and that's something that's significant, and you can't do both. You can't disparage what they're doing and not recognize the importance of it at the same time, and therefore you have to recognize that there is some importance important endeavor there that has to be credited and has to be facilitated, and therefore we have to find out how to find the balance there and how to make that easier and how to acknowledge the efforts of Brit Gedolim in order to make that possible and to see how to assess the Hetz Mechira in light of that. So once again, you see the sense of responsibility emerging, and it's extremely striking and impressive to recognize just what that effort suggests. And then the chapters that follow that also reflect this mentality in different ways. So the chapter after that has to do with the theme of Yerusha and the idea that the Torah has certain requirements in terms of inheritance. So by Torah law, we know that inheritance is twice the portion for the firstborn and only for sons, and not at all for daughters unless there are no sons. And yet, nowadays, we have a system where we recommend equal inheritance for all children, for sons and daughters, which seems to be completely at odds from what the Torah describes, and yet this is widely accepted in all circles. So how exactly that developed is a fascinating topic in of itself. And yet here again, you see the rabbinic responsibility emerging and balancing all kinds of factors, most prominently among them, the crucial imperative of family harmony and just how important that is. And of course, this is something that was very dear to my father's heart. So I think there's a chapter he very much would have appreciated. But you see throughout how that value is held paramount and how the assumption is that that's also a part of the Torah's intentions and that the crucial value of family harmony and avoiding strife is considered to be something that is so significant, it's understood that that can be incorporated within the allocation of assets, and that that's something that the Torah is assumed to accommodate as well, and therefore everything that flows from that is incorporated into that process as well. And then we deal with also the concept of siyumim, and how that has emerged as a mechanism to allow firstborns to eat on Erev Pesach, and somewhat more controversy nowadays, meat and wine during the 9 days, and some of the discussion that has surrounded that, but also efforts to be Melamed Zchus, to see those developments in a positive light, and how that reflects perhaps a positive embrace of the idea of excitement about Torah at the inception of the Jewish people on Erev Pesach, and also the idea of recognizing the importance of achdus and enthusiasm about learning during the 9 days when we mark the destruction, and the Talmud tells us that the temple was destroyed because of sinas chinam, because of division, and because of abandonment of the Torah. So our coming together and celebrating the Torah in a group together, in a sense of unity, and eating meat and drinking wine for the purposes of mitzvah, like we did in the Beis HaMikdash, is a way of emphasizing the theme of what we are aspiring to in a positive way, not as a distraction from the Chorban, but rather as an emphasis of what we are positively aspiring towards. So perhaps that limud zchus is also something that we can look to in an affirmative sense, and that's also something that emerges. And then basically the final chapter of the book deals with something that's very painful for all of us and for the Jewish community today, the Aguna crisis, and why that has become such a vexing situation, such a vexing challenge, especially in light of all of the other issues that we seem to have found methods to address, and try to detail why that is indeed so challenging and so complex. But at the same time, to recognize the tremendous potential connected with the halachic prenup, and to detail why it is that the halachic prenup is so effective, both in terms of what it accomplishes, but also in terms of the values that it highlights, while it maintains the integrity of Jewish marriage and also emphasizes the unity of the Jewish community and addresses what is essentially a gullus problem and brings back together the idea of the values of Jewish community and of mutual respect that has sometimes been eroded in the years of exile, and all of those positive values that emerge from reaffirming that as a standard, and how that's also something that rabbinic responsibility has developed and can turn to with greater emphasis, and that's a part of what we can try to advocate with a greater focus in that direction. And then as an appendix towards the end of the book, after emphasizing again the crucial importance both of avoiding cynicism and of recognizing the power of attention to all of these values, There's an appendix that focuses on one specific source that actually comes out of the sugya of Gittin and of addressing recalcitrance in that area, and that is the very striking position of the Rambam. Maimonides writes in the laws of Gerushin, in the laws of divorce, that even though a get has to be given of free will, nonetheless, there is the possibility sometimes of coercing a get when the halacha requires one, and that seems like a direct contradiction. And yet the Rambam explains that it's possible because there is the assumption that everyone deep down wants to do the right thing, what you might call the pintaliyid, that we assume that inside there is the inner ratzon, there's the inner will to follow the Torah's desire, and that even if someone is screaming that that's not what they want to do and that they have other interests, we assume that internally they actually do want to do the right thing, and that we just have to convince them, and that that will emerge. And what's fascinating is that you find that throughout the literature, that principle is utilized in other contexts. So you find that, for example, in the Mechiras Chametz literature, or in the Heter Iska literature, that you find poskim such as the Chelkis Yaakov and others saying that what if you have an arrangement for a supermarket with Mechiras Chametz, or you have a Heter Iska, where you have one or other of the parties who are not religious, or are not interested or not aware of what's going on, so would you still assume that the Mechiras Chametz, for example, in that circumstance, should still be valid if the party who's involved isn't necessarily really committed to it, isn't necessarily really religious or aware of the details? Would you assume that that's still valid? And while some said no, they have to really be committed and they have to really be religious and pious, there are others like the Chelkis Yaakov who said that we assume deep down, everyone wants to do the right thing. The Rambam's position by Gerushin of the Pintaliyid is the dominant mentality here, and that even if it doesn't look like they're otherwise concerned, we can still use that as the guiding principle. And this has shown up throughout the generations in the literature as a principle that poskim have utilized and have taken as a guiding light, the assumption that even when all other indications are the contrary, there is this inner Jew that wants to do the right thing, and rabbinic leaders have used that as a principle to make decisions in terms of policy and to assume that there's something to come back to when everything else is brought into place. And that itself is fascinating, and I think something, again, that I think my father would very much have appreciated. And we'll just maybe close by noting that some of the poskim, the Chasam Sofer and others, have tried to understand where exactly that principle comes from. The Rambam's idea that there is this inner Jew who wants to do the right thing, and even if it seems like he doesn't want to do the right thing, still we can take for granted that deep down he does want to do the right thing. Where exactly does that principle come from? So the assumption is that maybe it comes from Matan Torah, the fact that we were all together at Har Sinai and our spirits were all there and we all said Na'ase B'Nishma. So even if we're now very far removed from that, maybe that original gathering at that time implanted something in all of our collective souls, which we assume that we can return to, and that's where it's all collectively rooted from. But the Talmud tells us, actually, that even at that time, we weren't totally committed, and that we had to be convinced by God, so to speak, to come along, and that it took a later point in history for us to really come on board. That it was only after the miracle of Purim that we really recognized just how beautiful a gift the entirety of the Torah was. The Medrash suggests that it was the Torah Shebaal Peh that we were slow to appreciate, that maybe the Torah Shebichsav, we said Na'aseh B'Nishma, that we were excited about, but the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, with all of its details, with all of its complexities, so that seemed burdensome, maybe that we were cynical about, and that seemed like too much. And then, in the aftermath of the great miracle of Purim, we're able to look back and to appreciate just how glorious and how beautiful everything is, and then we accepted everything willingly. So too, we are anticipating Purim this coming week, and we're in a difficult time for the Jewish people, but we hope that with the great light of Purim coming up and recognizing God's great glory and hashgacha and providence, we should also be able to look back and to recognize that sometimes things that seem very dark and difficult to understand is also part of a larger picture. And just as there's so much that we sometimes don't understand until we're able to see more and able to appreciate more of what's involved and see the larger picture, then there is greater light. We should all be zoche, we should all merit to see that greater light soon in the future, and the Jewish people should see miracles and nisim and nuflos in the month of Adar, and we should all know only shalom and Yeshua in the months ahead. And thank you so much.